I recently was given a tour of Pepperdine University by the Dean of the School of Public Policy. And the last thing he said to me at the end of the tour is that Pepperdine was trying to build a university that was worthy of its location overlooking the Pacific Ocean. One of the people who has contributed to that is our next speaker, Andy Jengert. Andy's a professor at Pepperdine. He is also the author of a recently published book through the Acton Institute called Inhabiting the Land, A Case for the Right to Migrate. Andy Jengert.
Thank you. I want to make 3 points about immigration in the U.S. One, there is a right to migrate, but it's not what you think it is. It's not an absolute right, and it doesn't mean open borders. Two, the economic stakes of immigration are relatively small. If there are any real stakes, they are cultural. Three, illegal immigration, with special emphasis on the qualifier illegal, as opposed to undocumented, is the source of our most severe immigration problems and is our most urgent challenge. Let's begin with rights. My dissertation research was narrowly focused on the economics of immigration and assimilation. Several years ago, I was asked to write a paper on Catholic social teaching and immigration. So for the first time, I had to read what the popes had said about it. I was shocked to find in Catholic social teaching a very clearly announced, enunciated right to migration. Now, in my research on this topic, I had never come across the term rights in the context of immigration. Since I'm a product of an American rights culture, the claim of a right to migrate was bracing. Rights language is fighting words in America. Rights are employed as rhetorical trumps or clubs in the U.S., and they often indicate an unwillingness to compromise. Appeals to rights are usually conversation stoppers. But you don't have to look very far beyond my narrow world of economic research to discover the important rights context of U.S. immigration policy. The 1965 Immigration Reform Act, which made possible the mass migration of the last 40 years, should be understood as part of the civil rights movement in the 60s. It was an international counterpart to the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. Just as all citizens were to be treated as equals before the law, regardless of race or creed, all those seeking to become citizens should be treated equally, according to that logic. Today, rights language is as out of control in immigration politics as it is everywhere else in U.S. politics. Today, we hear about the right to driver's licenses for illegals, even the right to citizenship. So what do the popes mean when they assert a right to migrate? It turns out they're speaking from a tradition in which rights claims need not be absolute, which is more comfortable with trade-offs among rights. In this tradition, the right to migrate is not absolute. The purpose of rights language is not to end public policy debates and disagreements, but to orient them towards the common good of all persons, natives of the host country and immigrants alike. In this tradition, rights are simply the flip side of justice. To have a right means that someone else has an obligation toward you in justice. To claim that someone has a right is to claim that something is due to him. The value of looking at rights from the side of justice is that it allows us to talk more naturally about the necessary balance among our obligations. We can't determine what is just towards one person without considering our obligations towards others and our scarce resources. In fact, since rights language is so unhelpful in U.S. discourse, it's more helpful to approach this topic from the direction of justice. In the U.S., when we say immigrants have a right to migrate, it becomes difficult from this perspective to consider abridging those rights in favor of the rights of natives. We speak of clashes of rights. But translate the rights talk into justice talk, and we can more naturally speak of the balance between our just regard for immigrants and our just regard for the common goods of economy, culture, and security. Our just obligations towards others arise from their dignity as human persons, made in the image of God, placed in the world according to his purposes. It's in this sense that we're all created equal. We have a common destiny. Anything that bears on a person's development as a human person deserves our just respect, even solicitude. When seen from the perspective of justice, the right to migrate is not absolute. An absolute right, like the right to life, involves access to a human good that has no substitute. When we abridge someone's right to life, we can't expect that he'll be able to pursue his happiness through other means. Without life, there is no human development. When we abridge someone's right to migrate, however, we are foreclosing only one avenue for his development. Many immigrants can feed their families, find fulfillment without migrating to America. Those for whom migration is a crucial avenue of development, refugees, those trapped in desperate poverty and dysfunctional economies, have a stronger claim on us and a correspondingly stronger right. Now, if our obligations and justice toward migrants put at risk our common goods as a society, our economic order, our culture, our security, then our just obligations to our own citizens and to ourselves may force us to curtail the right to migrate. It's important to note that restrictions on migration need not imply a denigration of the migrants themselves or of the value of migration to them. The benefits of immigration to immigrants themselves, the economic benefits of higher pay, remittances, perhaps potential benefits to dysfunctional nations of having an overseas community that has experience in a free society, these should figure into our policy deliberations. If we self-protectively curtail immigration, it's fitting that we do so with a sense of regret and reluctance. We should not do so lightly, in any event, without consideration for those who stand to benefit from our generosity. And as an aside, I think the U.S. Historically is very generous in this way. A healthy rights perspective allows us to balance our generous welcome of immigrants against the burdens of immigration. It's to these purported burdens of immigration that I now want to turn. These fall under three headings: economic, cultural, and security concerns. In the economic realm, both the estimated costs and benefits of immigration are relatively small. The National Academy of Sciences estimated that immigration increases the incomes of natives by $10 billion a year, which seems like a lot of money until you compare it to an $11 trillion economy. Immigration is neither destroying nor enriching our economy. Its continuation does not make us particularly richer, and its curtailment will not ruin our economy, no matter what it does to farming in California, to chicken processing in Arkansas, or to the nanny market in New York. The numbers are simply too small to matter. The economic stakes are relatively small. The supposedly alarming estimates of the net cost of immigration to government at all levels are similarly relatively small, although they are trumpeted as if they are outrageously high. Careful estimates of the net fiscal cost of illegal immigration to the federal budget, for example, which doesn't count the modest benefits of immigration to Social Security, suggests that illegals impose $5 billion more in costs than they pay in federal taxes. Again, this seems like a large number, especially when the B in billion is pronounced with explosive emphasis, like it is on talk radio, $5 billion. This number cries out for some perspective. $5 billion is 0.2% of the $2.1 trillion federal budget. It's 1% of the federal deficit. The federal government loses five times that much annually. Employees at the Agricultural Department were tallying up $5 billion a year in credit card fraud until recently. The federal government gives $80 billion a year away in corporate welfare, $30 billion of it to agriculture. Farmers in the Central Valley in California alone receive as much as $400 million a year just in water subsidies. Waste and fraud in Medicare eat up $20 to $30 billion annually. In perspective, the $5 billion cost of illegals, maybe it is a big number, but it's not that big when compared to the federal budget. The only economic numbers that come close to being significant are the fiscal burden of immigration in California, already mentioned by Peter, and the effect of immigration on the wages of uneducated native workers. The $5 billion fiscal burden on the state of California and its localities, the cities, Medicaid and education costs, is large when compared to the state's structural deficit of $6 billion. But even this can be put in perspective when compared to total state and local spending in the U.S., which total $1.5 trillion a year. because the fiscal burden of illegals is concentrated in a handful of states, mostly California, Texas, Florida. Those states do have a strong case for federal help. It is a burden on those states. Perhaps the most troubling economic effect of immigration is its modest effect on the wages of unskilled workers. Immigration has decreased unskilled wages by at most 3 to 4% over the last 30 years, modestly. There's a small effect over three decades. But it does fall on the most vulnerable, workers who are already adversely affected by trade and information technology. So it should be troubling to those who place native interests above immigrant interests. Compared to the gains to immigrants from immigration, a quintupling of wages for unskilled workers from Mexico, tens of billions of dollars sent back to poor Mexicans each year, the losses to unskilled natives are relatively small. Moreover, a reduction in immigration will not protect native unskilled workers from the effects of free trade and information technology, which have combined to account for much of the stagnation in the wages of the unskilled. It should also be noted that the stakes are small in the debate over choosing skilled versus unskilled immigrants. Native workers do not benefit as much from skilled worker immigration as they do from unskilled worker immigration. And the gains from unskilled workers, as we've seen, are small. Even the gains to GDP per capita are dubious. Canada, whose skill-based immigration system is cited as a model for the U.S., has experienced growth rates in GDP per capita, which are significantly smaller than U.S. rates during the last two decades in which the U.S. inflow of unskilled workers has been greatest. Skilled immigration may boost living standards, but not by enough to notice. So the economic stakes in immigration are small, costs or benefits. The cultural stakes, whether they're large or small, generate the strong emotions that overshadow immigration debates. There seem to be two major cultural concerns. One, are immigrants from non-European cultures in some way less suited for healthy democracy? Do they lack the habits of compromise, self-reliance, and association that support U.S. institutions? And two, is a multi-ethnic society necessarily prone to division? Is immigration a threat to national unity? My expertise is the economic aspects of this issue, so I don't have as much confidence in addressing the cultural aspects. Nevertheless, I have several questions and observations that I think need to be raised on culture. First, it seems strange to me that we should favor immigrants from white Europe on cultural grounds. Should we really prefer, say, 100,000 devoutly secular, globalistic French over 100,000 religiously devout Mexicans? Perhaps we should, but I need to hear more discussion about what habits Europeans can bring to our democracy. It's not obvious. Perhaps devout Mexicans carry more healthy Western traditions into the U.S. than do Germans, Brits, and Italians. Again, it's a question that I'd like to hear more on. Second, an important piece of data on assimilation, economic and cultural, is intermarriage rates. Intermarriage has always been an important route for assimilation, as well as an indicator of assimilation. High rates of intermarriage played an important role in assimilating the Irish, for example. These rates are generally high for Hispanics, about 40%, which bodes well for their assimilation. Third, just briefly, the English language is obviously crucial to this story. A basic knowledge of English should be a requirement of immigration. Fourth, this is not the first time that a non-white immigration has occurred in the U.S. Southern Europeans were not identified as whites in the 20s. They hailed from alien cultures, alien religions, and were thought to be unsuited for the American experiment. The fact that we lump Italians, Greeks, and Hungarians together with Germans and Brits into a category we call white is a testimony to the assimilation of the inassimilable. To discuss security stakes in immigration brings to the fore the most troubling aspect of our immigration problems, the large numbers of illegal immigrants who live among us in plain sight, particularly in Southern California, where I'm from, or Miami. There's a long tradition in Western political thought that demands that laws be enforced, even to the point of recommending against passage of laws that either are not enforced or not enforceable. Laws which are universally ignored tend to undermine all respect for law and corrupt the culture. We should either enforce our immigration quotas or repeal them. The presence of 12 million or so illegals in the U.S. is corrupting our law enforcement, our politics, our economy, and undermines our ability to protect ourselves from terrorists. This corruption is the biggest threat from illegal immigration. The corruption begins with the consciences of the illegals themselves. Millions of otherwise good people are living a lie, pretending that they belong here, have rights here, and denying that there's anything wrong with their being here. Their illegal status undermines their ability to bargain for better wages, to resist abuses by employers, and their incentive to learn English and assimilate into U.S. culture. They're more likely to remain in immigrant enclaves, seeking safety in numbers, and that works against their assimilation. Illegal immigration corrupts our politics, since it forces us to pretend that laws we have passed democratically are not worth enforcing. Illegal immigrants even have their own lobbying groups. Some illegals vote, no doubt. The advocates for illegal immigration insist not only that we tolerate their illegal presence, but that we pretend that the breaking of our laws is a trivial matter, not to be brought up in polite company. We're even forced to pretend that the biggest problem caused by illegal immigration is the lack of documentation, not illegal status. It's not politically correct to call illegal immigrants. We must instead call them undocumented workers. Instead of deporting illegals, we must develop new forms of ID for them, matricular consular IDs instead of passports, driver's licenses just for them. We must treat them like they're legal, granting them in-state tuition in our public schools. Our lack of desire to enforce immigration laws corrupts the Immigration Service. One often hears complaints about how awful the INS used to be and how it would not be possible to enforce immigration laws without a complete overhaul of the Immigration Service. Much of the dysfunction at the INS was due to the impossible task it was given, to pretend to enforce the immigration law while not really enforcing it, to catch and release illegals, to go through the farce of informing illegal immigrants of their right to make bogus asylum claims. The immigration services are demoralized not because they're incompetent, but because they're not allowed to do their jobs, although they must pretend they're being vigilant. You try that job. The desire to appear to enforce immigration law, while not really enforcing it, has led to our policy of building big fences at the border, but not looking for illegals internally. This lopsided enforcement has been counterproductive. Before the era of vigorous border enforcement, the typical illegal immigrant stayed in the U.S. for about a year and did not bring his family. Illegals cycled in and out of the U.S. After the border became more difficult to cross, the average stay in the U.S. lengthened considerably to about 3 to 4 years. Immigrants who got across this tougher border were less likely to go home, not surprisingly, and were more likely to bring their families and to settle down, to demand driver's licenses and schools for their kids. Most importantly, the presence of an underground market for smuggling and fake IDs undermines our security. Drug smuggling and human smuggling go hand in hand. Terrorists may use well-worn illegal entryways and take advantage of the false ID infrastructure already in place. It's easier to hide in plain sight when there are already 12 million people doing that. I suspect that addressing the problem of illegal immigration will solve most of our immigration problems. To the extent that immigration depresses wages, it's most often the wages of legal immigrants. The ability to actually enforce the law would reinvigorate the Immigration Service. Legal immigrants are more likely to assimilate than illegal immigrants. If there are fewer illegals and we're not bashful about searching for them, then there'll be fewer ways for terrorists to hide in plain sight. Of course, you can accept that illegal immigration is a big problem and suggest different ways of dealing with it. You might eliminate all illegal immigration by opening the borders and giving out free green cards, or you might actually enforce the laws on the books. I favor the second option. I'm not concerned about the large volume of legal immigration, although I would make some changes in our current legal system, putting limits on family visas, for example, and putting more emphasis on English language proficiency. But I believe that illegal immigration as a burden is much more urgent, and this is what I recommend focusing on. Thank you very much.